UK Wine Show, show number 155. Wine Bottles with Paul McLevin. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 155 for the 8th of May 2009. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we're talking with Paul McLevin from OI. Paul works for OI, one of the largest bottle manufacturers in the UK and the world, and we talk to him about how wine bottles are made. In the spotlight, we review the book The Oxford Companion to Wine by Jancis Robinson, and you may recall last week we had the grape variety Pinot Noir. This week's mystery grape, if you can guess it, is grown all over the world and often thought to be the most widely planted white grape variety around, but sadly this isn't true. It's so adaptable to climates, it can be grown in hot Australian deserts, right through to the cool parts of northern France and Italy. While you ponder what grape it is, next up we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Fine wine merchant Berry Brothers & Rudd is to close its Dublin store at the end of July and make 12 staff redundant after 10 years of trading. Berry Brothers blame the high cost of operating a retail unit in Dublin, which delivered an inadequate return on investment, as opposed to the economic downturn. The lease was up for review, and apparently the time was right to leave. That's according to Managing Director Hugh Sturgis. As well as the shop, there was a wholesale business supplying restaurants and a hospitality arm. The company hopes to continue to serve Irish customers by shipping from the UK.
Well, BBR pulling up their bridges. It's not surprising with the Celtic Tiger licking its wounds. Canny Irishmen have probably lost a taste for top-end wines. It's not the best environment for them. One company bucking the trends is Penfolds. What's going on there?
Well, Penfolds has released the lineup of wines for 2009 that will feature in its ongoing luxury and icon Australian fine wine range. The release includes the 2004 vintage of the legendary Grange at a price of £170 a bottle, which they suggest is best drunk between 2016 and 2050. Chief winemaker Peter Jago believes the 2009 release is one of the best yet for Penfolds and boasts some exceptional wines.
I've heard claims that it's one of the best vintages in the last 20 years. It certainly has the price tag. And with the release price of Grange now more expensive than the last release price of Bordeaux, it's interesting times. A wine that I don't think will reach these giddy heights is a new vineyard in London.
Yes, London's first commercial vineyard has been planted at 40 Hall Organic Farm in the London borough of Enfield in North London. Nearly 1,500 Bacchus vines were planted as part of a wider community project funded by Capel Manor Horticultural College. The Bacchus grape is ideally suited to a cool climate and produces a crisp, light white wine with Sauvignon characteristics of gooseberry and fresh grass, says vineyard manager Sarah Vaughan Roberts, who hopes the free-draining gravelly soil at 40 Hall will become the terroir of London wines. Both still and sparkling wines are planned, and happily the wines should come on stream in time to toast the opening of the Olympics in 2012. Whether they actually will use the wine, though, remains to be seen, because the 40 Hall wines will be sold directly to consumers within a 10-mile radius of the vineyard, and all profits will go to promoting sustainable urban agriculture in the local area. This news comes a month after vines were planted near to King's Cross by Alara Whole Foods in their sunny south-facing back garden measuring 45 metres by 8. The vineyard will only produce 100 bottles a year and will be supplied to a local restaurant. That's all from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk for these stories in full.
Cheers, Jane. I'm not sure about London wine, but if the environment doesn't kill the vines, then it's got a good chance to grow in the London terroir. But it's good to see some London vines being planted, especially with English Wine Week starting on the 21st of May, not too far away. So next week's Spotlight, we're going to be looking at which wineries to keep an eye out for, what's going on for English Wine Week, and what are the top wines in England at the moment. But next up, we've got this week's Spotlight, which is a book review, The Oxford Companion to Wine by Jancis Robinson, 3rd edition. The Oxford Companion is one of the great wine reference books and a must for any serious wine student or hardened wine enthusiast. I myself used the 2nd edition heavily when I was sitting my WSET diploma and was upset when I lost the book. Now, with a shiny new 3rd edition, how does this weighty tome stack up? The third edition layout hasn't changed. It's still similar to an encyclopedia with 787 pages and over 3,000 entries from grapes and growers to vineyard genetics. You name it, it's in there. Terms are in alphabetical order, followed by a description, with descriptions ranging from simple sentences right through to multiple page explanations. Jansis' writing style is authoritative and firm. And while this book may never get any reader particularly excited about wine, it is an essential reference book for wine students and the hardened wine enthusiasts. The key thing with any reference book is how easy is it to find the information you want, and how accurate is it? In both these cases, the book is excellent. The simple A to Z styles allows fast searching, and with an index at the back ordered by topic, it's easy to scan and find out if what you're looking for is included. Accuracy is the other element of any reference book, and in general, accuracy is excellent, although some sections are even now starting to become dated. The third edition was published in 2006 and already has become slightly dated, especially with references to the fast-changing New World wine regions and the grapes they grow. That said, my favourite section, due to some work I'm currently doing, is a list of the Controle regions, such as the Appellation Controle or the DOC in Italy. It also lists the varieties allowed in the small and useful appendix. In a nutshell, if you're a student of wine, then this book is an essential reference. If you are a hardened wine enthusiast, it's probably quite useful as well. And in the end, I gave this book 97 out of 100. And that's the highest mark I've given for a wine book yet. If you've got the book, it might actually help you as well working out the grape variety. How are you getting on with our ubiquitous white grape variety? It ranges from rich sparkling wines and full buttery wines in hotter climates and steely varieties in the cooler climates. It's probably the best known white grape variety, and the key characteristic to this noble variety is often its yellow skin and early budding, which can make it susceptible to frosts. I'll give you the answer to the grape after our interview with Paul McLavin from OI. We're going to be talking to Paul about wine bottles and how they're made. And during this, we debunk some of the myths about bottles. The interview forms some background wine knowledge, which will be useful towards the end of the month when we start looking at a four-part series about recycling wine bottles and the environment. But for now, get ready to learn everything you want to know about how wine bottles are made. Hi, I'm here with Paul McLavin from OI. How are you, Paul?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. You're the sales manager at OI.
Yes.
And what is OI?
OI is the biggest glass packaging company in the world. We have operations in Europe, the US, Australasia, South America, and we produce both glass containers and also the technology to make glass containers.
Fantastic. Today we're going to be talking about how to make a wine bottle, of all things. I've just had a lovely tour of the factory. Furnaces, it's certainly the place to be on a cold day. Perhaps not the best coming into summer here, but yeah. It must get quite hot in that factory.
Certainly does, yeah. Especially on an 8-hour shift.
Yeah. Okay. What we're going to talk about today, as I said, is manufacturing and all that sort of stuff. But OI, you've got a couple of factories in the UK, haven't you? You've got one here just north of London that we're at the moment, and one in Edinburgh.
In Alloa, just in central Scotland.
Central Scotland, sorry. What do you manufacture in these two regions, and why do you have it separated over two regions?
Alloa is really ideally situated in the heart of the Scotch whisky industry. We primarily make spirits containers up there, although we do make some beer and soft drinks for other markets. At the Harlow plant, we make primarily beer containers in the past, but we have spread out recently into soft drinks and wine containers, as you saw today.
Yep. Yeah, saw some nice wine bottles there, so we'll talk a bit about that. Just before we get into the manufacturing process of glass, because I found it quite interesting going around the factory. I like that sort of stuff. There's been a lot of talk recently, or about 6 months ago anyway, about a shortage of glass throughout the UK and Europe. Are you aware of that? Because when we tried to talk to glass manufacturers, they were quite tight-lipped about it all.
If you go back, there was a period of time where stocks of glass bottles were tight, and there was a lot of demand coming through from the market. Because we have a process that runs continuously 365 days a year, it's very difficult to suddenly bring on a lot of capacity when there are peaks of demand. So there was a period of time when we certainly struggled slightly to keep up with all the demand, but OI and other glass companies have been investing in additional capacity, especially in the wine sector. And Harlow is a good example of that, where if you go back 2 years, we weren't making wine bottles here, but we are now. But we do need the long-term vision and forecast to be able to make the necessary investments to support the industry.
Well, let's talk about the process anyway, because I love processes and things like that, and I like going around factories. What are the raw ingredients for a glass wine bottle?
The main element is sand.
Yep.
Sand will produce glass just by itself, but requires a very high melting point and isn't very easy to deal with. So we then add soda ash, which allows the temperature that it will be formed at to be reduced. We then add limestone, which gives a more durable material, which gives glass its inert and secure and stable properties.
Oh, okay. And do you just add them all into one big pot?
Yep, they're basically mixed in a large cement mixer-style device. And then sent to the furnace to be fused together and melted.
What proportions of each? You said it was mainly sand?
It's about 70% sand, then 15% soda ash and 9% limestone. Although those measurements will vary slightly depending on the type of glass you want to use.
Doesn't quite add up to 100% though.
There will be other minor elements added to give colour or reduce colour.
Yep.
Natural glass will tend to have a slight green tint to it because of iron in the sand. So we do add decolorizers to get a clearer glass for clear glass.
They call it flint glass, the
flint.
White stuff.
That's right.
Is that what you add, flint?
No, it's a metal called selenium, which naturally would give a pink tint, but the pink and the green cancel each other out to give a slight grayness, but a clear glass.
Okay, excellent. All right, so you've got your different bits and pieces. They're in a big vat, and you feed them into what look like a dirty great heater. Certainly the sort of thing that keep me warm in winter. How hot does it get in that furnace?
The furnace is about 1,500 degrees at the crown, or the very top of the furnace. It's about 5 foot deep.
Yeah.
It varies depending on the actual tonnage of the furnace, but I think the largest furnace we have in the UK is about 5 foot eight.
5 foot eight. I'm 6 foot. So you described it as a swimming pool when we were having a look, but... I might have my neck out of the water, but I don't think there'll be much left to me.
Yeah, unfortunately, I am 5'8", so I wouldn't even have that.
I think in the long term, it wouldn't make any difference. We both jumped in.
It'd be a short swim.
Yeah. Okay, so it goes into this furnace, and how long is it in the furnace for? Is it for a short period of time? Is it a long period? It's a continuous process, isn't it?
So. It's a continuous process. By the time it's melted and being conditioned, it may be in there for 24 hours. Between the material going in one end and coming out the other.
And you said that it was heated from the top. Is that quite common?
Well, it doesn't seem naturally obvious. You often assume that you'll heat things from below.
And then you get the currents lifting it up to the top.
Exactly. But to be more efficient, the burners are above the surface of the glass, and the furnace is shaped in such a way to reflect all the heat into the glass. And then any exhaust gases are taken off into a regenerator where the heat can then be drawn back into the furnace.
To preheat the gases?
Exactly.
Okay, so using a bit of efficiency there.
Yes.
You had two sides that fed the gas in and you swapped them over about every half hour?
Exactly. We burn from one side with the exhaust gases going out the other side, and then after half an hour that is swapped over, so then... what was heated up with the exhaust gases then warms up the induction gases as it sucks it in from the other side.
Do other glass plants use any sort of, instead of trying to use it as a preheater, maybe using it to produce electricity or anything like that? Because I've been to bigger furnaces for steelworks and they have a lot of waste heat that gets used for electricity.
We tend to get as much heat as we can out of the regenerator system. I'm not aware of other glass plants using other technologies to do that.
Okay, to recover that. Yeah. Okay, so it's this molten glass. I presume it's all reacting and doing what it needs to do inside the furnace and mixing up.
Yeah. Initially, you have to actually fuse the sand and the other raw materials and melt down any recycled material that you've put in. You want to melt those all together. You then bring it to a hot spot, which will allow any impurities or bubbles or anything to rise to the surface, giving you good clear glass at the base of the tank where that can then be pulled out.
Okay. What about impurities? Do they float up or do they stay where they are, or how does it work?
The main impurities would probably be unmelted material, so that'll float around for a while longer until it does melt. You can get some impurities through recycled material, and those will unfortunately eventually just come out the furnace.
Okay, and then into the bottle, in which case they get rejected.
Exactly.
Okay, so the glass has been in the furnace for 24 hours or a period of time. What happens next after that? Because you obviously don't pick up a big lump of molten glass. How does it work?
Not far off it, but the glass is taken down a channel called a forehearth, which is like a small canal, and then comes to an orifice ring where it starts to pour from above floor level down to the machine, which is below it. There is a set of shears that will cut the flow of glass, so that there are lumps of glass of the correct weight and shape to be formed into containers.
They look like just bits of cylinder, really, as they, yeah, almost like a stream, and you're just chopping it off and then the cylinders fall down, yeah?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. And what happens then?
The molten gob of glass or lump of glass falls into a mould, which we refer to as the blank mould, mm-hmm, and is formed into a rough shape, a paraffin shape. Now, this is done in one of two ways. Either compressed air is used to blow the rough shape in the mould, or we use a plunger to... a plunger is forced into the glass to put it into this paraffin shape, form it into this paraffin shape.
That particular shape looks... You showed me one earlier that had been cooled down. It looks like a really funky test tube with a dirty, great fat bit of glass at the bottom.
Yeah, we need a lot of glass in the bottom half because that then has to spread out and form the base of the bottle.
Okay, so if you think about it as that initial blank mould, I think you called it, wasn't it? It is like a test tube, but it doesn't look anything like a bottle. Or I suppose you could put a liquid in it.
Yeah, the paraffin shape is designed really to place the glass in the right positions so that when you do the final blow, then it will form the shape with the right thickness of glass in the right areas.
I noticed we were watching some screw cap wine bottles being produced, and that blank shape had the screw cap already formed on that rather than later on. That seemed to be strange because the rest of the bottle is just a mess, and then you've got this lovely screw cap being, yeah, produced. What's going on there? Why have they done it like that?
The finish really does require the tightest tolerances, because that's where it's going to interact with the cap. And the tolerances on the finished dimensions are tighter than anywhere else on the bottle. Forming it at the beginning of the process gives us a couple of things. One, because the glass is most molten at that stage, it gets into all the details of the finish better. And two, when you move it over to the second half of the process, you've got something to hang the paraffin shape on into the blow mould, so that you can then blow it out into the vinyl shape.
Okay, so it's really just something to hold on to as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So then afterwards, the bottles seem to get tipped upside down.
Yep, they're flipped over into the blow side of the machine.
All right, just before they do that, you mentioned a plunger that goes into the bottle. That looked a bit crazy, but I presume that's to create the hole that you can then blow the air into, because you can't blow into a flat bit of glass, really, can you? You need it.
That's right. The plunger's used on a process called narrow neck press and blow. And the concept there is that the paraffin or rough shape is formed by the plunger being pushed into the gob of glass and filling up all the space. So basically, within the blank mould, there is only glass or plunger.
Oh, okay. So there's no bubbles in there, is there?
There's no bubbles.
But it makes it really quite a tight fit.
Exactly. And the idea there is you distribute the glass exactly where you want it. Mm-hmm. With the blow and blow process, you use compressed air, and that will distribute the glass well within the paraffin, but not as exactly as narrow neck press and blow.
Okay, because you can construct the shape of that plunger into all sorts of funny shapes to be able to create a particular shape within it.
It has to be a tapered plunger so that it can be withdrawn back, yep, out of the gob of glass.
Yeah.
But what that allows you to do is actually use less glass, because you've put the glass exactly where you need it. So it means you need less extra glass to allow for variations in glass thickness.
Okay. So we've created a sort of a template of what the bottle will be eventually. It was still quite red hot at that point.
Yeah.
And then it moved to the blowing section, and there was a machine that just sort of picked it up and turned it over, really, isn't it?
Yeah. At the blank stage, the closure end or the open end of the bottle is at the bottom, and then it flips over so it's at the top, and the parasol shape is actually hanging from the finish.
The screw cap, yes. Yeah, it's jargon. You wait until I talk about wine. Okay, so then another mould seems to come out. It gets clamped again, doesn't it?
Yep, the blow mould closes around the parasol shape, and then compressed air is used to blow that out to form the final shape.
I read somewhere that the reason we have 750ml bottles is because a glass blower could only blow about 750ml. That was a lung full of air.
Yeah, traditionally that was the restraint or the constraint in the capacity of the bottles.
They must have big guys for magnums.
Yes. Yeah.
It's blown then. It's still quite red hot, but you've got a mould as well. That mould, the glass sort of just fills the mould, doesn't it? We were talking about punts earlier,
yes,
which is an interesting thing because, to me, a punt is something that you use to hold the bottom of the bottle if you're in a swanky restaurant to pour nicely and it looks flash, but also adds a bit of weight to the glass as well. From your point of view, what purpose would a punt do from a glass manufacturing point of view?
You'll tend to have a small punt to give more strength and control in the base of the bottle. So you need a certain amount of raised glass, because if you try to form a flat base, one of two things is likely to happen. One, because the glass is still pliable, it may well sink, and then instead of sitting soundly on the table, you'll have a rocking bottle.
Oh yeah,
not much use. Also, if it's going to flex up and down, then it's going to change the capacity of the bottle, so you have less control over ensuring you've got 750ml in there. The depth of the punt also gives us some challenges, because when the parasol starts to blow in the blow mould, it goes straight down initially. So it actually touches the top of the punt quite early on. Now, as soon as it touches that cold metal, it starts to cool down and stretch towards the edge of the bottle. So if you have a very tall punt, you actually need a lot of glass to ensure that you get to the corner without going too thin. So the deeper the punt, then likely the heavier the bottle.
Okay, that makes sense. I've always told people, you know, people say, you know, is the size of the punt a good indication of the quality of the wine? And whilst there's no explicit connection to it, you normally find people who manufacture wine that are expensive can spend the money on the extra glass, because you do need extra glass for a punt.
Yeah, we have actually done some research, and there is still a percentage of people that believe that a heavy bottle means a good wine.
Yeah.
So there is still that belief, but I think there is more of a move towards people recognising that, you know, there is a need to reduce packaging, and lightweight in bottles is one way of doing that.
All right, so the wine bottle's effectively formed at that stage, isn't it? You know, you've got the top, the neck formed, the finish, you call it. Yeah. Even though it's done at the start, which is excellent.
That's the glass industry.
Yeah, you were saying earlier that's because in the old days when they were blowing it by hand, they used to just stick the finish on at the end
of the process.
Yeah, it was a separate process.
So exactly, you used to form the bottle and then add the finish at the end of the process.
Or the top where you put the screw cap.
Sorry, yes.
I've noticed on a lot of bottles there seems to be a seam. I've always assumed that bottles were just sort of stuck together and that was the seam from that. That's not the case, is it?
No, there will be a residual seam just where the join line on the mould is. Mm-hmm. In some cases, you can almost see two seams because you've got two sets of moulds. So you have a blank seam and a blow mould seam. But normally you only ever see the one, and we tend to try and keep it fairly faint.
Is the seam a weak point in the glass?
No.
Because I've read, and I've done sauvage before, you know, where you whip the top off with a sword. And
yes.
The
when you read up about that, people say, you know, you follow the seam because it's the weakest point. And where it hits the neck, that's the weakest point as well. So when you're doing sabots, you run the sword up the seam, hits the neck, and that's the triple point, so to speak, where the glass is its absolute weakest. Is that true, or is that a load of poppycock?
I'll go for the poppycock answer. what you tend to do is, I've seen the guys do the old sword trick, and quite often what you try and do is either create a very minor fracture by sort of tapping it and then take it off with a sharp blow. But we don't tend to recommend that in day-to-day use.
No. I used to open beer bottles with a fish slice at a barbecue, and that worked quite well as well.
Yes.
It's not as quite as classy as a sabage and a sword, but it works the same.
Yeah.
Okay, so is that... Now the bottle's been formed, we've got our wee seam in the bottle, everything looks pretty good. Is that the last process?
No, the bottle, as you say, is formed, but because you've taken it from about 1,100 degrees to 600 degrees very, very quickly, there are stresses in the glass.
Mm-hmm.
So really it's not available for use yet. So straight after forming, we had a hot end treatment, and the hot end treatment really acts as a primer for later treatments that you're going to put onto the glass. It then goes through a layer or what probably looks like a long pizza oven. And that takes the glass from its 600 degrees and cools it more slowly. And that allows all the stresses to be released.
It's like a tempering process.
Exactly. So that the strength of the glass is improved.
You don't actually heat it up again and then cool it down.
You take it back up to about 600 degrees. Okay, because it's probably cooled a little bit from leaving the forming machine to going to the layer.
Okay, and then that drops it gradually in all the glass.
Yeah.
Are there crystals in there aligning? Is that the way you think about it, or is it it's just removes stress?
I think the best way of thinking about it is when you've cooled it very quickly, the surfaces of the glass have cooled and contracted quicker than the glass in between.
Yeah.
So it's compressing the glass in the middle.
Yeah, okay.
So if you do anything to the surface of the glass, all that compression is going to let go.
Do you see the bottle shatter?
It can do if you were to take an unannealed bottle and scratch it, it would break.
Okay.
So what we do is we put it through the layer. That allows the glass to cool consistently and removes that pressure. Mm-hmm. So if you scratch a surface, it's a scratch, but it's not going to give way straight away.
Sure. And there was another process straight afterwards where you seemed to be coating the bottle in something.
It was a cold end treatment to add lubricity to it, to make it...
Lubricity, that's a fantastic word, but what does it mean?
The idea is the surface of the glass feels a bit like a chalkboard when it's because it is that sort of material. It's a sand-based material. So we put a coating on it that allows the bottles to slide over each other. And that really helps them going down our line and also the filling line.
Mm-hmm.
If we didn't do that, they would scratch against each other and you'd get this white ground deposit on the bottles.
Sure.
So it helps protect the bottles and aids the filling process.
Okay, so you just sort of put it almost, if you look at it like a, it's not a plastic coating, but it's like a coating to make it a bit more smoother.
It's a lubricant, basically, just to help them slide over each other.
And does that stay on the bottle forever, or...?
It certainly survives the filling process, but if you were to reuse a bottle, so if you imagine milk bottles, that coating will be washed off over a time.
Yeah, I have noticed milk bottles often have a... If you rub milk bottles together, they do sort of a wee bit. Yeah, I have noticed that, actually. Okay. That makes sense. All right. And then obviously you've got to check the bottles.
Yes. You form these bottles very quickly. You're using high pressure and high temperatures. So there is the possibility to form small thermal cracks or checks or for the inclusion of impurities. So we inspect it through a number of stations to automatically reject those.
In terms of, what about changing lines? Because I saw some beer bottles being made and I saw some wine bottles being made as well. The beer bottles are quite small and the wine bottles a bit bigger. How easy is it to change from a beer bottle to a wine bottle? Or
there's degrees of difficulty. So if you're going from, say, one 400-gram wine bottle to a different 400-gram wine bottle, that change can be done relatively quickly. If you're going from a 187-mil wine bottle to a Magnum, You have to change the orifice ring where the glass is coming out from the furnace, yeah. The timing of the shears, the blank side of the moulds, the blow side of the moulds, the cold end equipment, the inspection equipment, the palletization equipment. That change can take a long time.
Hours, days?
You could be sort of 4 or 5 hours.
Changing over.
Yeah.
Okay, so you want to run continuously, don't you?
The longer the run, certainly the better.
And it seemed like a furnace supplied one bottling line almost. You've got two furnaces running. What happens to all that glass that's building up in the furnace? Does it just stay there or does it keep...
The glass is flowing out of the furnace all the time. Even when we're doing job changes, we will take the glass and cycle it back into the furnace. There's a couple of reasons. You don't want the glass to stand in the channels coming from the furnace because there's the chance that it will then freeze and block up. So, yeah, really, you keep the glass flowing at all times.
So you just drip it onto the floor, so to speak?
Well, we take it down into the basement and back round into the furnace.
Okay. So. All right, now that makes sense. Okay, and last question is the export-import, this is just a question for you guys more than anything else. Do you export any of your glass here, or you mentioned you import some glass as well. What's the situation there?
Generally, because when you're shipping glass, there is quite a lot of air involved, you tend to try and make the glass near to your end market. Within the Owens Group, what we tend to do is make it near the end market where possible, but in situations where there's either specialities or production efficiencies with centralising the production, then we may import or export glass. So, for instance, if a customer comes to me at the moment for a dead leaf wine bottle, or a Foy Moore wine bottle as it's also known, I would probably ask or obtain that from my colleagues in France who are making it continuously. It's possible for us to make it, but if it's just the occasional load or a small quantity, then it makes more sense just to bring it in from somebody else.
Because you've got 4 hours to turn around as well as getting it right.
If you're changing colours, you could be talking days to change over. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, because you've got to drain the furnace first, don't you?
You have to change the whole colour of all the glass in the furnace, so that can take up to a week depending on what colour.
And what do you do with all the glass that you're manufacturing in that changeover?
That would probably go into the green furnace because it'd be a mixture of colours, so it can then be used just as recycled glass.
All right then, Paul, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Paul. Glass bottles for wine is something we often take for granted, but watching the dripping hot molten glass form a bottle is amazing, and such a complicated procedure that can be automated and create so many bottles so quickly. It's fantastic. We're going to be talking with Paul again in about a month's time when we talk to him about glass recycling from a recycler's point of view. But before we finish up, how are you getting on with the mystery grape variety? A noble white grape variety, which is quite common but sensitive to frosts and grown in all sorts of climates, is, of course, Chardonnay. And to finish up with, we have a fantastic double up. We have a quote from Jancis Robinson talking about Chardonnay. And she describes Chardonnay as the tart of all grapes because it would lay down and do what it's told. That is to say, it'll grow anywhere and is quite amenable to the winemaker's influence. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.